Hey, Questioning Medicine listeners, before we get started with this episode, I am headed to Washington, D.C. next week. It's my first time to the D.C. area, so what are some good recommendations? Where should I go? What should I do? Where should I eat? What should I drink? I need to know. You can always email me, Andrew Belt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, and let me know. I appreciate any help or suggestions you can give me. Now, let's get on to the episode. Welcome back, Questioning Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. It is that time again where we start to dive through some literature. We start to get in what I'm getting on. We start to talk about what I'm talking about. And when I say we talk about, I mean I talk and you just listen because this is a podcast and we can't do it any other way. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. As I said in the intro, it is time to talk about what I'm reading about, get on what I'm reading, and dig into the inquisitive mind of your humble host. So sit back while we enjoy this fireside chat. So the first thing we got to talk about is, as I've mentioned on here before, Joe and I are doing Right on Prime. We're doing what's called the Guideline Guys, which is where we break down guidelines, the good, the bad, the ugly, whether we think the evidence actually exists or it doesn't really exist. It's a fun little take on guidelines. I suggest that you go check it out. If you don't have a script to MRAP, I understand, I get it, but you should get one because it is so much information all in one and you don't really need to go anywhere else. But I digress. Here we go. One of the guidelines that we recently did was on the HIV virus and the United States Preventive Service Task Force. You see, the task force has recommended for many years now that every single person be tested for HIV. And if you're at high risk, you are tested more frequently. But at least once, if you are over the age of 15 to 65, you fall in that category, which is a whole bunch of people, then we should be testing you. This new 2019 guideline is no different. It also says we should test individuals 15 to 65. And there's a separate, additional, brand new, shiny, spanking, polished guideline that says if they're at high risk, so if you think that, ooh, I should be testing this individual because they're at high risk to get HIV, but then you test them and they're negative, so a high-risk negative individual, then you need to have the conversation with that individual about prescribing them PrEP treatment. Yes, prophylactic treatment, now in guidelines, which is awesome for two reasons. One, because PrEP seems to work. It does have an improvement on HIV. The medications are getting better, the side effects are getting lower, and we're talking about a 2 to 3% absolute difference in acquiring HIV. And if you are religious and actually taking the medication, some trials or some studies have shown up to a 0% acquiring HIV. I mean, 0%. I talked about it in a previous podcast, but this means eventually, if we did this properly, where we treated HIV and then those were at high risk, we gave them medication so they didn't acquire HIV. HIV, as we know it, could be essentially in our lifetime a disease that we would never see again. It would poof, vamoose, be gone from the world. That'd be in the ideal situation. But again, we know it's not all ideal. And one of the things that annoys me the most is we now have fresh, new, shiny information from the CDC. The CDC in their report says HIV testing in 50 local jurisdictions accounting for the majority of new HIV diagnoses and 7 states with disproportionate occurrence of HIV in rural areas, 2016 to 2017. Basically, 2016, 2017, they looked at areas where there were a lot of HIV reported cases. And wouldn't you know it, in those areas, the areas that they're seeing it a lot, so they should be screening a lot, at least everyone 15 to 65, because that's what the guidelines say, 60% of U.S. adults have never had an HIV test. 70% of people with higher HIV risk were not tested within the past year. The individuals that came in and had risque lifestyles, if you were doing IV drugs, maybe sleeping around a little bit for money, call it what you will, not tested. In order to stop the spread of HIV, we have to test. There is evidence out there that we should never be ordering a CBC that is screening. Ever, not once in the physical exam, but yet it is done all the time. There is evidence out there that we should never be ordering just a screening BMP or CMP, but yet in a screening yearly physical, it is ordered all the time. There is evidence out there that we should be ordering at least a one-time HIV screening, and yet we are never ordering it all the time. We have to have the conversation in order to have the conversation. In order to test, it has to be brought up. And if you think, again, if you think the person's at high risk, you need to be talking about PrEP. HIV could be a thing of the past, but we have to do our job so patients can do their jobs and take the appropriate medications. Now, if I have said it once, I can tell you that I have said it 100,000 times, and that is patients know their bodies better than we, the provider. Even though we went to school for 30-something years, they know their bodies better. In particularly, women know their vagina better than a male provider or better than a female provider. You might be saying, Andrew, what on good God green earth are you talking about? Well, of course, I'm talking about the Lancet Oncology 2019 performance of HPV testing on self-collected versus clinician-collected samples for the detection of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia of grade 2 or worse, a randomized paired screen-positive non-inferiority trial. Whew. If you couldn't gather from the title, basically they had patients test themselves with a self-swab, or they had the provider go in and do a very close test. Test the cervix, make sure you're getting the transitional zone, and if you know you're in a study that's testing your testing versus the patient's testing, don't you think that the providers were probably just a little bit more careful than they normally would have been to make sure that they got the maximum amount of cells? Don't you think that they would have done everything they could, up to the nines, if you will, to make sure that at least they were non-inferior, if not superior? Well, if you've listened to any part of Questioning Medicine ever in the past, then you know that I am a big fan of the self-swab for HPV. I'm also a big fan of the self-swab for gonorrhea and chlamydia. I think that you doing the actual pelvic exam has limited utility these days, and we could go down the whole rabbit hole, or at least limited utility when we're screening for cervical cancer, because a woman can test for HPV just as good by herself. Let's get into the fast facts of this trial. This is a randomized controlled non-inferiority trial. It was called the IMPROVE study, the IMPROVE IT. Now, if you couldn't tell from the study title, basically they invited a bunch of women, in fact, 190,000 women, to this trial, and only roughly 16,000 of the women came into the trial. They said, yeah, I'll be in the trial. They split those 16,000 women up into two arms. One arm was, hey, you got to do a self-swab. The other arm was, hey, you have to go into the provider. Now, the nice thing about the self-swab was that they mailed the providers, or they mailed the patients, excuse me, the sample. They mailed them the brush. They mailed them the whole device, everything. They gave them the post-it to mail it back. They could do cancer screening from the privacy of their own home, in their living room if they wanted to, or in the bedroom, or in the bathroom, or wherever they wanted to. It didn't matter. They could do it in their car. It didn't matter. All they could do the self-swabbing whenever they wanted to, where the women, obviously, that were clinician-based, had to come in for testing. Women in the HPV self-swab self-testing group, HPV positive 7.4% of the time. What about those in the clinician samples? Well, 7.2% of the time. Relative risk ratio, 1.04. Confidence interval, clearly crossing one. There was no difference. Oh, yes, that's right, because a woman knows her body. She knows where to stick the little swab, where to turn. She can find it just as good as we can, and she can do it from the privacy of her own home. We don't need her to come in. We don't need to waste time and hours and energy and utility and resources. No, 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 no. we can have the patient self-swab at home. And I cannot wait to the day when you can just over-the-counter buy a self-swab kit and mail it off. It'll be amazing. I don't know when that'll happen, but it should already be happening. I suspect there's a little financial influence there in the medical pharma industry. But if you want to apply this into practice, let's say you just want to have the person do a self-swab in your office, you should note two things. In this study, it was the Evelyn brush sampling device that was used, and they used PCR-based assay. That is super important, that second one. It's the PCR-based assay. In my take of the literature, when you're doing self-swabs, when you're doing HPV testing, actually, basically, in general, you should be doing PCR-based assays. Now, as far as the Evelyn brush sampling device, I don't think that really has anything to do with it. I looked it up online for a little bit. It looks basically like every single brush that I've ever seen used for cervical sampling or testing. They're one in a million out there. I don't think the brush itself had anything to do with it. But PCR assays for HPV testing, that is what you need to know. And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, let's get something very clear. We now have colon cancer screening and cervical cancer screening, which could be done from the privacy of your own home. And not only can be done from the privacy of your own home, it's actually just as accurate or just as good or finds just as many cancers as are invasive in the hospital, in the clinic, clinician-led test. I think the problem with starting this is convincing providers that this is beneficial. And this is beneficial because we are wasting a huge amount of resources on the cervical cancer screening. And a huge amount of the time, the patient is HPV negative. Remember, in this study, it was 7% HPV positive, which means 93% of the time, over 9 out of every 10 patients is going to be HPV negative. And if we know that they're HPV negative, we know that then they are cervical cancer negative. No disease, no need for an office visit. We could save 9 out of every 10 visits into the office. That is a whole bunch of time, a whole bunch of resources that would be beneficial, not only for us, but for the practice, for the next patient that wants to get into our booked schedules. This is huge. Share it with your friends. The next article seems to humor me a little bit. In fact, it humors me a lot because there is a over-the-counter supplement you can get out there, and it's called Big Penis. I am not making that up. It is absolutely called Big Penis. And you see, this medication was used for... I'm actually not going to tell you what the Big Penis medication was used for. You can probably guess, but... inside of this medication, it was being recalled, or a notification was being sent out by the FDA because this over-the-counter medication contained Viagra. Yes, that's right. A medication called Big Penis contained Viagra, and the FDA is warning people, hey, you probably shouldn't take this over-the-counter medication because if you're on things like, you know, blood pressure medications, it can cause some bad outcomes, nitrates. It can cause some bad outcomes. If you have a heart attack and you don't know that you're on this, basically, Viagra, it can cause some bad outcomes. I'm only bringing this up as a sample for you to remember when you're talking to your patients about their herbal over-the-counter supplements and how they swear, oh, it's all natural. It's so healthy for me. Because I know that's the argument that comes about. And how do you say, yeah, it's... all natural, you think, because that's what they put in the label, but because it's given over the counter as a supplement, there's no actual FDA requirements or regulations on it, so you don't even know what's in it. You could actually be buying a pill called Big Penis with Viagra in it, or you might be buying a pill called, I don't know, costochondroitin that has Viagra in it. You don't know what's in it because it's not regulated. Anyways, enough with that. And you might be pessimistic or you might be optimistic about changing your patient's mind, but speaking of pessimism and optimism, let's jump on to the next study. And that, of course, is in JAMA Internal Medicine, Assessment of Self-Reported Prognostic Expectations of People Undergoing Dialysis, the United States Renal Data System Study of Treatment Preferences. Whew. You see, it doesn't matter if you're a pessimistic person. It doesn't matter if you're an optimistic person. When it comes to your prognosis, almost everyone is an optimistic person. We would like to think, oh, we will live longer. Oh, we will never die. Oh, cancer will never happen to us. Oh, we will never end up in a hospital. And oh, we will live forever. But we know that can't be true, and that is no more clearly seen than in this study. So let's dig into some quick, fast facts on the study. You see, 60% of U.S. patients undergoing hemodialysis die within 5 years. And only 20% of individuals that are on hemodialysis live more than 10 years. In this study, they surveyed close to 1,000 patients, and they asked them, how long would you guess people your age with your health conditions on hemodialysis, just like you are, usually live? And they didn't just say, you know, pick a random number. They said, do you think it's less than 5 years? Do you think it's 5 to 10 years? Do you think it's more than 10 years? Or do you have no stinking clue? You were just not sure. Well, the results were that 11% of the people responded that they thought they had less than 5 years to live. 33% said, oh, I have more than 10 years to live. And the majority, 40%, were unsure. But remember, 60% of people actually die within 5 years. But when we asked them, only 11% of the individuals said that they had 5 years or fewer to live. And only 20% live over 10 years of age or 10 more years. But 33% said, oh yeah, I definitely have at least 10 more years in me. I think it is obvious and clear that people are much more optimistic than the reality. But we can't blame them, because when you watch TV shows, everyone always lives. What does that mean for you, the provider? What does this mean for you? It means you need to be aware that if your patient is undergoing hemodialysis, the odds are over 50% of the time, over a coin flip, if you will, that they will be dead within 5 years. It means you need to have the life and death conversation. You need to tell the patient, we need to get the things in line. Who's going to make your decision? Let's get your power of attorney. Let's get your healthcare proxy. Let's get your living will. And the patient may say, no, we don't need to do that yet, because you see, I'm going to live over the next over 10 years. But we know that statistically speaking, they will absolutely not live over 10 years. And with that being said, on to the next article. We are closing up here on right around 20 minutes. So I will make this my last article, and we'll end this podcast as we've ended every one before it. I'm sure you have all heard the statement before, fake it till you make it. But what if fake it till you make it was more than just a saying? Maybe it would be a way of life, and not only a way of life, but a better way of life to help you live longer. And I know that might sound like a motivational speech, but it's not. It's actually this study published in JAMA titled Association Between Subjective Well-being and Living Longer Without Disability or Illness. So in this study, they had almost 10,000 adults with a mean follow-up of 6 years, and they used data from the first six waves of the ELSA to calculate life and health expectancy. You might be saying, what is the ELSA? Well, it's this super intense biennial longitudinal survey that they give to those age 50 and older in England. And oh my goodness, is it intense. You can search it, ELSA. This is like a 50-page research project. They're just saving all this data. I don't even know what we're going to get out of it. But then they used that information, did micro simulations with the individual data to simulate how long you're going to die. The two health expectancy outcomes, the two outcomes that we're looking for here were disability-free life expectancy, so how long did you live without having a disability, and chronic disease-free life expectancy, how long did you live without having severe chronic diseases. In each wave of this big ELSA study, they were also asked, how functional are you on your activities of daily living? Are you able to dress, walk across the room, bathing and showering? Are you able to prepare your own hot meal? Do you go shopping for groceries on your own? Are you able to make your own phone calls? If you were not able to do at least two or more of those, you were considered disabled, which I think is fair, because if you can't do even one of those, I would say, ooh, we're going down a bad path. In each wave, they also asked patients, what about your health conditions? Do you have CHF, diabetes, stroke, pulmonary disease? They tried to figure out what is happening here. And then they asked them about their happiness. Again, this is like a huge, ridiculous survey. And they said, On a scale of 1 to 4, tell me, do you still enjoy things? Do you still enjoy the company of others? Do you look forward to hanging out with friends? Do you have a sense of happiness? Do you feel like you have energy on most of the days? They asked them a depression scale, and they said, are you depressed? Do you feel less motivated or less excited about activities? You can get where this is going. You see, they tied up how disabled are you and how depressed are you? How many chronic diseases do you have, and how satisfied or happy are you with your overall well-being? And they connected all those in a very kind of complicated, convoluted equation that isn't probably the best, but it's the best that we have right now. And the results were 50-year-olds that considered themselves depressed or low enjoyment of life, then the life expectancy was 27 years for men and 31 years in women. But if you were one of the individuals that had high enjoyment, no depression, you were feeling good, feeling groovy, a spectacular, phenomenal, can't wait to be any better 50-year-old, then you gain an extra 6 years. If you were a man, up to 33 years of age. And if you were a woman, about the same, 5.5 years extra of life. And you might be saying, well, that's good, but just the mood. I mean, just the mood makes you feel better for an extra 6 years. Were you living a better life during those 6 years? If you were depressed, then disability-free life expectancy, so how long you lived until you were considered, quote, disabled, starting at age 50 was 20 years for men and 21 years for women, meaning you basically went to age 70 and 71 before you were considered disabled. So basically, they're then spending the last 33% of their life after the age of 50 considered as disabled. But those individuals that had high enjoyment, those individuals that were happy, feeling spunky, feeling alive, feeling free, no depression whatsoever, they had, for men, an extra 30 years of disability-free survival, and for women, 31 years of disability-free survival. But remember, men, you lived up to 33 years, so you only had the last 2 years that you were considered disabled. Women, you lived up to 36.5 more years, so you had basically the last 4 years that you were considered disabled. Said differently, instead of living the last years of your life, the last 33% of a 30-year follow-up as disabled, of those last 30 years, you were only living closer to 12% of them being considered disabled. And remember, this had nothing to do with exercise, nothing to do with diet. It just had to do with how depressed are you? How happy are you? Oh, and what's your disability? Now, is micro simulation the best? Is that the best we can do? Obviously not. Does it make sense that if you are depressed, you are more likely to get chronic disease? And if you get chronic disease, you're more likely to be depressed? I would say absolutely. And if you are depressed or have higher rates of disease or are less functional with your activities of daily living, do you have higher rates of mortality? Yes. In the end, I think the Disney movies had it best, or at least one of them in particular, and that is, of course, Hakuna Matata. It means no worries for the rest of your days. And with that, let's wrap this podcast up like we've ended every single one before it. Let's see if we can wrap this up in 30 seconds or less. All right, here we go. We are not testing people for HIV, even though guidelines since 2006 have recommended that everyone be tested for HIV. We're still not doing it 13 years later. It is time now to do it. Speaking of time now to do it, it is time for the self-swab to be done by the patient at home, because the patient versus the clinician testing is exactly equal. And then we can save time, we can save office time for people who actually have a positive result. We don't need to waste office time on the over 90% of individuals who are going to be HPV positive. There's a drug out there called Big Penis. It is sold over the counter. You can probably guess what it does. And I'm sure those that bought it over the counter said, oh, it's so healthy for you because, like, it's all natural and, like, it's so healthy. Yeah, it's not all natural. It's not regulated. And it actually contains Viagra. This is just a great example that you can give to your patients that we don't know what is in these medications that they're getting over the counter. Now, I know everyone thinks that they will live forever, and that includes individuals that are on dialysis. But in reality, 60% of individuals that start dialysis will die within 5 years. You need to have the end-of-life conversation sooner than later. Get down their wishes on paper so we know what to do when that time comes. And last but not least, if you want to live longer and you want to live longer without disability, then no worries, be happy. Hakuna Matata. All right, that ends this episode. I will close this one like I've closed every one before. So until next time, keep the quest in questioning.